Welcome to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. KY's Whitehead. I'm joined now by Dr. David Satcher, an award-winning physician, scientist, and public health administrator. He was the first African-American to serve as the 16th Surgeon General of the United States, the first Black four-star admiral in the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, the first Black to serve as the 10th Assistant Secretary for Health, and the first Black person to serve as the 13th Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Satcher is the founding director and senior advisor at the Satcher Health Institute at Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. He is the author of a book entitled My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. Dr. Satcher, it's an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. How are you today, sir?
Fine. How are you? It's good to be with you.
Good to have you here. We have so many questions that we've been pulling from our viewers, questions that we've been researching ourselves that we want to get into the conversation. Health disparities were a big issue in the Deep South, and even more so now with COVID-19. The Deep South exposed the health disparities amongst African Americans. Can you talk about the disparities kind of from the 1940s up until where we see ourselves today?
Well, I think disparities in health have been with us for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And you may remember in 2000, when we released the Surgeon General's Healthy People 2010 report, there were only two goals. One goal was to increase the years of healthy life that people live as they age. And the other goal was to eliminate disparities in health. And so it's a real challenge, continues to be, as you said, continues to be a challenge for us as a nation and as a people.
So what came out earlier this week is there was a study that was done that looked at life expectancies of African Americans, and it found that Black men lost 3 full years of life expectancy in the first 6 months of 2020, and Black women lost about 2.4 years or so. Can you talk about why our life expectancy is going down? I understand COVID-19, but what does that really mean?
Well, I think certainly when you have a new challenge to our health, like COVID-19, then it reduces life expectancy. And so even though, as you pointed out, our life expectancy has been short compared to whites in this country. We're all losing years of life expectancy as we deal with this problem of COVID-19. And in the paper that we did back in 2016 about differences in life expectancy, we put it in terms of years of life lost, and basically showed that African Americans lost, just take the year 2000 alone and compare life expectancy there with the life expectancy of whites. Even at that, looking at that window of going from one decade to another, you can see that the decrease in life expectancy is dramatic. This was a paper written by Dr. George Russ and myself.
Can you explain?
What if we were equal is what we called it. What if we were equal?
What if we were equal? But for some people who may not understand, when they hear that life expectancy has been lost, does that mean as a Black woman, I'm going to live 2.4 years less than I would have lived before 2020? Does that mean that my health is getting worse? Like, what exactly does that mean that life expectancy is going down because of COVID-19 from
last? That's a very, very good question. To talk about life expectancy, you have to talk about a group of people. You can't do it on the basis of one person. You have to say that out of 100 Black women and 100 white women, and you compare the number of years that you expect them to live, then you can talk about losing years of life lost. And that's what we did in the paper that we wrote in 2005.
And with that in mind, I know that for you, that it was because of a Black doctor who treated you, I think when you were 2 years old, perhaps, that had a great impact on your career. Dr. Hrabowski, the president of UMBC, an African-American man, talks about how it's important for young Black people to see Black doctors so they can see themselves in that position. Can you talk about the doctor who influenced you and why it's important for us to see role models that look like us?
Well, I grew up in Alabama. Grew up on a 40-acre farm. I was in the middle of 9 children, and I became very ill at the age of about 1.5 to 2. And Black doctors were not allowed to admit patients to the hospital during that time. This was the early 40s. So my dad went to town and convinced the one Black doctor in Anniston, Alabama, to come to see me, and that was Dr. Jackson. Dr. Jackson came out to the farm. He spent the whole day. He warned my parents when he left that he didn't expect me to live out the week, but he wanted them to know what they could do to make me comfortable and increase my chance of living. And well, the rest is history. Here I am. Survived. I will always appreciate the fact that Dr. Jackson came out there to the farm to give it his best shot. And I think that's all that we're asked to do, is to apply the knowledge that we have and to try to give everybody the best chance, not only of surviving, but surviving the maximum years.
And like Dr. King, you have devoted your life to the civil rights movement. You were actually arrested on multiple occasions. Can you tell us about the work that you have done, the civil rights activist work that you have done to ensure that African-Americans and other people of color have the same access to health care and treatment as their white counterparts?
Well, sure. I was sort of introduced to segregation and discrimination very early. I think I was four and a half, five years old when I went to town with my brothers, and I had saved my money because I wanted to buy an ice cream cone. So I went in the drugstore and asked the lady if I could have an ice cream cone. They were only 5 cents. And she said, no, we don't serve Blacks in here. She didn't say Blacks, but let's use that for the time being. So that was a real shock to me, because it's one thing to talk about segregation and discrimination. It's another thing to live it and to understand what it means, you know, for a four-year-old, five-year-old to go to town excited about the fact that he has saved money and is going to get an ice cream cone, and ends up being told that he can't be served because he's Black. That was my introduction. But it was really not until I got to Morehouse that I became really active in the movement. I have to give people like Otis Moss, a name you might know,
yes,
outstanding minister, who had just finished Morehouse and was in divinity school. He and Marion Wright Edelman. Marion was a sophomore at Spelman, and Otis Moss had just finished Morehouse, and they got together, and they were the leaders, along with a couple of others. They were the leaders of this student movement. And when I heard about it, I said, this is my chance to really fight for what I believe. Now, this was important because now I went to Morehouse to plan to become a physician. So I didn't go there to go to jail. So that was not my plan, but I went to jail because I felt that this was important. And if we didn't deal with this issue of segregation and discrimination, our children, our grandchildren, and others were going to pay a price, more than an ice cream cone.
What you have, Dr. Satcher, is you also have the long eye of history. Like, you have seen how we have come through so many trials and tribulations. Last night, a young person said to me, I feel like we're in the Matrix. We keep fighting the same struggle over and over again. And I pushed back and said, you know, it may be a struggle. It's not the same struggle. Sure. Can you talk a little bit about that? That some people, some young people feel that we're fighting the same thing over and over again. You were there.
Well, you know, it's interesting in that you say that, because last night I was watching the history of the Black church, you know, Henry Gates Jr.'s program. And at one point, talking to the person who was with me, I said, you know, it looks like we keep fighting these same battles. When I was reminded again about the four children who died in the Birmingham 16th Avenue Church, I spoke at the 50th anniversary of their death a few years ago. But it just reminded me last night that we have a lot of battles that we continue to fight because real change, you know, eludes us. It just escapes us in terms of people. So we have to keep fighting. And sometimes you get tired, but you have to keep fighting until the battle is won.
Now, in your first year as Surgeon General, you released the 1998 Surgeon General's Report, Tobacco Use Among U.S. Racial Ethnic Minority Groups. And in it, you reported that tobacco was on the rise among young people in each of the country's major racial and ethnic groups, threatening their long-term prospects. Now that you can look back, can you talk about whether or not things have gotten better? And I'm thinking, of course, with the use of all these new drugs that have been introduced into the market, vaping and those type of things, or have things gotten worse when it comes to tobacco use among the African-American?
Well, I can say, and I'm delighted to be able to say, things have gotten better when it comes to tobacco use. Now, in 1964, when Luther Terry released his report on tobacco use among Americans, 43% of the American people were smokers, and there were fewer African-Americans smoking than whites. However, today, less than 15% of the American people are smokers. So we've made some progress when it comes to tobacco use. And that's why it's a very important point here, because that's why it's so important for us to keep fighting, because we may not win all of the battles, but we have to continue to work to win as many as possible. Tobacco use is a major killer in this country. It's a major killer of African Americans. So to the extent that we can improve the life expectancy and the health of African Americans.
Now, Dr. Satcher, we have found very recently that more Black women are dying during childbirth than, according to the New York Times and the study that was reported there, than they did during the latter half of slavery. And you couple that with this belief that Black folks have a higher tolerance for pain. Can you talk about some of the medical racism that still exists that makes it hard for people to, say, trust a vaccine?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book about that, the book that I released in September. There's a whole chapter that deals with reproductive health and the fact that African-Americans suffer more in the process of pregnancy and childbirth, et cetera. Black women, twice as likely to die, during pregnancy and delivery as white women in this country. So there is a difference. And we're still trying to patch up the areas where there are differences. Mm-hmm. We were trying to make sure that when it comes to pregnancy, Black women are determined to be pregnant as soon as possible, but also that they have good care from doctors that they trust while, during their pregnancy. Unfortunately, even until today, many Black women don't seek care until later in pregnancy. And that's dangerous because, especially if you have risk factors. Mm-hmm. Risk factors, hypertension is a major risk factor during pregnancy, right? Obesity is a major risk factor. These are things that increase your risk of dying during pregnancy. You put these things all together, and Black women are twice as likely to die during pregnancy than white women. We can change that. We have to change that.
Dr. Satcher, how do we get people within the African-American community to trust the COVID-19 vaccine? Where do you stand on that? Because we are doing a special push for our show to help dispel some of the fears and concerns and the hesitancy around this. What's your professional opinion? How do you convince people?
Well, number one, I'm very concerned that we have vaccines now, and I believe the vaccines can save lives. I've struggled with this issue of vaccines for a long time. When I went to the CDC, remember I was director of the CDC before I became Surgeon General. And one of the first things that I encountered was that Black children were not getting their immunizations, you know, especially the ones that they're supposed to get before the age of two. And so I developed a partnership with Black churches, the National Council of Black Churches, and asked them if they would help us to make sure that Black children got their vaccines. And I was very pleased with the job that the National Council of Black Churches did. They even immunized children in the basement of their churches. And I feel the same way about this vaccine. I believe that the benefits of the vaccine for COVID-19 far outweigh the risk. Now, everything has some risk to it. And I'm certainly familiar with Tuskegee. Look, I'm from Alabama. Tuskegee was the first college that I visited when I was in high school. I know about what happened in Tuskegee, but I also know how far we've come. When I was director of the CDC, I was able to get President Clinton to apologize, honestly apologize for the Tuskegee study, and to make some real commitments on behalf of the American people. So we can talk about what happened between 1932 and 1972. It was terrible, but we cannot let that prevent us from moving forward. We need to get rid of this virus, COVID-19, and it's gonna take vaccines to help do that. And I listen to people as they talk to me about Tuskegee. I know more about Tuskegee than most people do, but again, because I'm from Alabama and I've been there as director of the CDC. I worked with President Clinton. So I think it's time for us to move on to make sure that our people get the protection that they deserve when it comes to a disease like COVID-19. Don't forget, almost 500,000 people in this country have already died. Within 1 year, almost 500,000 people have died from COVID-19. Worldwide, over 2 million people. We're talking 1 year, over 2 million people have died from COVID-19. We got to move on. You know, it's easy to talk about what happened at Tuskegee, and I certainly will never rest if I thought it was still happening now. I don't think it's still happening now, but I do think that we are able to develop vaccines now that can prevent death from a virus that's killing people right in there.
Now, I just have a few more questions for you, and I'm speaking with Dr. Satcher, and I thank you so much for your time today and for helping us to understand it. As someone who sat as a director of the CDC, so you have the ability to kind of see out and see what's happening in this country when it comes to health. And as someone who sits on the board of Johnson & Johnson, the question that people are now asking each other, oh, which vaccine do you have? Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson. And I tell people, tell me the name of your flu vaccine, your MMR vaccine. You don't know, but we are so involved in this that it's almost overwhelming. So how do people understand the different vaccines, that they're more similar than they're different? If one is one shot with Johnson & Johnson and Moderna and Pfizer are two shots, for example.
Well, I served on the board of Johnson & Johnson for 10 years. I'm not on the board now. I'm too old to be on boards. I'm almost 80. But I'm very proud of the work of Johnson & Johnson. I really am. And I believe that when this vaccine is approved, it will make a big difference in terms of access to vaccines to fight the COVID. It is true that the vaccine was made by studying the virus. So any way you look at it, this vaccine, whether you look at the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca, all of these, they are vaccines that have the ability to reduce the risk of this virus. And with all of the people dying that are dying every day, we need to move forward. Mm. It doesn't mean, I want to be clear about this now, it doesn't mean the vaccine is perfect. It doesn't mean that every once in a while somebody will be sensitive to the vaccine. In fact, I think I probably have some sensitivity, but I'm so happy that I've had both of my vaccines with Pfizer. But I tend to be to have sensitivities in the spring. You know, I react to things. And so it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the vaccine. It just means we're all different. And so some of us are going to react differently than others, but not necessarily in a way that prevents the vaccine from doing its job.
How concerned should we be about the different strains, the South African strain, Brazilian strain, UK strain? Like, how should we kind of make sense of that?
You should be very concerned, and we should be working very hard. Because the good thing about that, of course, is that we now know that more so than I think any time before, the vaccine that was developed for this strain of virus is working in other strains. So when somebody says the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine works against the vaccine that was made in South Africa, that's great news. It just says that this is a very strong vaccine. It doesn't mean that that's always going to be the case, but we're talking about less than 1% of people reacting to negatively to the vaccine. For the most part, the vaccine is very effective. There is no question about that.
Now, my last question for you, you'll be speaking at a free event on Monday, February 22nd from 2 to 3 p.m. in conjunction with Promise Heights. Now, if people want to get more information, promiseheights.org. Can you talk about that activity that's coming up?
Well, I'm excited about being able to be involved in the program there. I think it's a very important program. I think we've got to do more, have more of these kinds of discussions. And I do a lot of speaking and writing. Of course, my book is just come out in September called My Quest for Health Equity. And I look forward to talking about that and to all of the different kinds of questions that will arise about my life. And I know you've read some of those stories. So, you know, the experience that I've had in terms of my life experience is something I enjoy talking about. I'm proud of my parents, neither of whom finished elementary school, but who were determined that their children were going to get an education. I've tried to make the best of that. And so that's what I look forward to. I look forward to discussing that and talking about Morehouse and... Yeah, I was the first Surgeon General to do a report on mental health. Mm. And I'm proud of that report because I think it is making a positive difference. And as you know, even with COVID-19, the mental health issue is front and center. People who've been infected with the COVID virus can suffer a type of mental illness. I don't think it's as serious as the disease itself, but it's a carryover from the disease.
Kind of the long-term effects and impacts of it. I think once we get through this vaccine, I do think other things are going to come, like you're saying, whether it's mental health issues, it's issues with young people being out of school for a year. It's this, even the health disparities of just spending your day sitting on the couch rather than walking around, the simple act of leaving the house. I think it's going to be a little bit of a challenge, Dr. Satcher. You're, of course, a lot more knowledgeable about this than I am, but I think it's going to be a bit of a challenge going back to whatever the new normal is going to be.
It is. Let me just tell you, as you pointed out, I'm almost 80 years old, very close. I mean, that close. But I believe that the vaccine, and I've had both, are much more beneficial than they are risky. And as I told you before, I think the risk is pretty low. It doesn't mean that there's not going to be somebody every once in a while who has a reaction to the vaccine. I react to things that you would never react to because of my allergies. People have different allergies. So it is true that some people may have a reaction to the vaccine, but the benefits of the vaccine far outweigh the risk. 500,000 people have died from this virus already this year in this country. And then worldwide, over 2 million people. It's a lot of people to die in 1 year. It's amazing. So yeah, the vaccine is not perfect, but certainly we need to get as many people to get the vaccine as we can. I strongly encourage it.
Dr. Satcher, thank you so much, sir. We appreciate your time.
Dr. Satcher. Thank you. It's great being with you. I'm sorry.
No, it's great having you. Dr. Satcher is an award-winning physician, scientist, and public health administrator, first African-American to serve as the 16th Surgeon General of the United States, first Black four-star admiral of the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, first African-American to serve as the 10th Assistant Secretary for Health, and the first African-American to serve as the 13th Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. His book came out in 2020, My Quest for Health Equity, Notes on Learning While Leading. Sir, it's been an honor and a privilege to speak with you, and thank you for your service to this country and, of course, to making your parents proud. Thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome. It's great being with you.
Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. So, did you hear the interview with Dr. Satcher, first Black man to head up the CDC, first Black man to be the Surgeon General? I asked him, dude's almost 80 years old, brother, point blank, I said, should we be concerned about the new strains? That's the UK strain that's been found in Maryland. That's the Brazilian strain that's been found in Maryland. That's the South African strain that's been found in Maryland and in Baltimore, may I just add. I asked him, point blank, should we be concerned? And he said, much to my dismay and despair, yes, you should. You should be very concerned about these new strains. Let me just say that at this point, we have, 500,000 people have died of COVID-19. I think they're undercounting. I think there are a lot more people. Worldwide, over 2 million people have died from COVID-19. In this country, I believe 26 million people have been infected with COVID-19. And there's still people who are saying, A, it's not real, and B, I don't need the vaccine. Again, not telling you what to do. I'm just saying, you need to figure out where you go from here and what it is that you need. 410-319-8888. We were talking about student loan debt. Mabel says the student loan debt, the owners of the loans are Democrats and Republicans. There's no way they're going to eliminate student loan debt. I tell my grandchildren, do not put in for a student loan. And one thing that has astonished me, and my granddaddy taught me, is that they are surviving differently than I did. I worked manufacturing for years and years, but they only work their own businesses, all of them. Do not get a student loan. Kim Fuller said, I agree, we should put with the caller. Put pressure on 46 to forgive student loans beyond $10,000. And if he does not take the necessary steps to forgive student loan debt, $50,000 and beyond, we need to move forward on reparations, lawsuits, legislation. Immediately, we need to do this. Kim Fuller says, loan payments go directly to the government. That's why they can forgive it, up to $50,000 per person. Jamila says, well, can I get mortgage debt cancellation? Jamila, exactly, sister. We're talking about our weekly wrap. And we have all these issues on the table. And so I want to open up the phone lines, Justina. I want to give people an opportunity to call me and put whatever they want on the table. 410-319-8888. I mean, it's countdown the crab cakes. And I say that with a whisper because, unfortunately, I'm sad to say that I am off crab cakes. I am participating in Coach Chauncey Whitehead. They call him Chauncey's Angels. I am participating with Chauncey Whitehead, along with the other angels, in doing this one-month challenge. And as you think about what you want to put on the table, let me just put this on the table. Now, my partner is Shay Brown, who is amazing. I mean, she has been... She gets up every morning. She encourages me. She sends me tags. She told me what scale to buy. She had me buy this scale, y'all. Okay. I'm talking about ruining your day. This scale not only tells you, it hurt my heart.
But the scale not only tells you your weight, okay, that's normal, but it also tells you your BMI, your body fat, your subcutaneous fat, your visceral fat. The visceral fat is all the fat that's around your lungs and your heart, your skeletal muscle, muscle mass, bone mass, protein, BMR, as well as the age of your body. Hear me out. It takes all that information and then it calculates based upon the information how old your body is. I just want to tell you, never have I been sadder this year than to use this scale, hook it to my phone, and get my number. So I am now talking a good game about crab cakes, but I am off crab cakes. And might I add, much to my dismay and despair, like I said earlier, I have not had coffee in 3 days. I have a headache so big I can't even see straight at this moment. I am trying to detox, get my body cleansed out, exercise, eat right. I'm trying to do the whole thing because on the other side of COVID-19, we also have to talk about how we take care of ourselves. So if any of the angels are listening, from Chauncey's angels, if Coach Chauncey Whitehead is listening, if my partner for the week, Shea Brown, is listening, thank you. I'm staying accountable. I may talk a good crab cake and fries game today, but when I leave, I'm doing what Shay told me, where I'm eating my dinner before 7 p.m. because I fast from 7 p.m. until 9 a.m. No food at all. And y'all, it has been a week. What do you want to put on the table? 410-319-8888. Miss Shane's on the phone calling about loan forgiveness. Miss Shane, how are you?
Fine, and you?
Well, apparently, without getting a crab cake this weekend, I'm not doing too well. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I was calling because I attended Sojourner Douglas College, and they lost their credibility. So I'm still fighting and trying to get loan forgiveness from there.
Ooh, yeah. That's actually a good point because with that, I mean, Sojourner Douglas College, but it closed June of 2015. So they lost their accreditation. So my concern to you is, are they're still expecting you to pay your student loans back even though you get nothing from the college?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. My hope is that President Biden will listen to people and go up to 50 grand. I think people do need that. I think that's a way that we can begin to level the playing field, and we have to do the work that we need to do to get that done. And I hope it helps you as well.
I wasn't going. Wasn't trying to finish it because it's like wasn't no school here in Baltimore City was willing to take all my credit. Only one was willing to take my credit was in Virginia, and I wasn't driving at the time.
So now with that, are you working to put pressure on Biden? Like, I think you should call your representative. Like, make sure that you do something. Don't let this opportunity pass by, because the more people to put the pressure on President Biden, the more he can find a way to get this done. Find your congressperson and put some pressure on, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, no problem. Thank you so much. 410-319-8888. A lot has happened this week. Texas has fallen apart and really should flip blue. I don't even understand how Texas can be a Republican state after Republican senators, congresspeople, local officials pretty much told the folks in Texas, fend for yourself, figure it out. Only the strong will survive. Your pipes are bursting. You got water in your house. Everything's freezing up. No electricity. You can't even drink the water. In Texas, they can't drink the water. They have to boil the water before they use it for anything because they think the water's contaminated. 410-319-8888. Leo Barros is on the phone. Leo, how are you, sir?
Wonderful, Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead. Stay on the firing line and never leave.
Thank you,
Listen,
sir.
Listen, regarding Sister Nancy Pelosi, she is proposing the establishment of a 9/11-style commission to investigate the January 6th insurrection, the attempt to overthrow the government of the United States.
Yes.
Why can't we substitute something for that, like the establishment and implementation of the reparations that we talk so much about for the descendants of enslaved people?
Yes.
I want her to. I don't want the Democratic Party to play this game, and they do it very well, of taking your eye off the ball, and we get into a debating cycle for the next 4 or 5 years, and not get to the meat and the heart of the issue. Let's make reparations a reality, and let's talk about the specifics of how that's to be handled. Also, the federal minimum wage, with regard to President Joe Biden and others, we need to up that federal minimum wage. I understand it's now $7.25. Mm-hmm. At least, at minimum, it's got to be $15 or more. Let's set up the parameters and hold our elected officials accountable, not just to talk about it, but let's do a roll call on where these elected officials stand, Ben Cardin and all these other folks who say that they are for our uplift and our benefit. Let's make it happen and make it happen now.
I agree. The way in which we go forward, because I think if we're able to get reparations, and let's be very clear, Leo, given the fact that it is difficult to try to get student loan forgiveness, do we really think that we're going to get reparations? I mean, I'm just saying, I'm being honest. I like to be hopeful, but Leo, I have no doubt that reparations will be very difficult to get in this country.
Are we going to get student loan? Are we going to get a break on student loans?
Well, he said.
In other words, which of our elected officials have committed themselves to making this happen, and who are on the record at the city, state, and federal level?
Well, the people that are on the record now calling for the $50,000 are Elizabeth Warren and Mitch McConnell, Ayanna Presley, and AOC are the ones who are being most vocal about it.
What about Maryland, the state of Maryland?
No, I have not heard. I don't know what, and I'm not saying they're not, but I have not heard anything as of yet. I have not seen my senator's name in the paper. I haven't seen my representative's name in the paper saying cancel the student loan debts. Where is John Sarbanes? I'm just asking for I'm in third district. I have not heard anything. I am not saying he's not in support of it. I didn't see his name in the list of people that are speaking out for it.
Where's Ben Cardin and brother Kwaisi and Fume?
I'm sure maybe I'm too quick to defend, but I'm sure Kwaisi and Fume, who helped found WEAA right here at Morgan State University, who's always worked for people who are struggling in this country and in this city, I'm sure he is in support of that. In fact, I believe I've heard him say something like that when he was a guest on our show.
Chris Van Hollen?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, let's call them out.
I'm saying it's interesting. The only one I can answer, I'm sad to say, I knew Kwaisi and Fume only because Kwaisi and Fume, even in the midst of the January 6th insurrection, Kwaisi and Fume, wherever he was hiding out, called our show to give us a rundown from the front lines of what was happening. When he went and did Henrietta Lacks, he made sure he contacted our show. So that's the only person that I can say, you know what? Even if I don't know his exact position, I'm sure he's in support of that.
Legislative Black Caucus on the Maryland state level, I don't know where they are. They're between the devil and the deep blue sea.
I think so. You know what would be interesting? I think we should all seek to have representatives like Weiss. We should be able to say, you know what? I don't know exactly where my congressperson stands, but knowing their record, I'm sure this is something they would support. I can tell you, I don't know. I don't know. All the people you name, other than Representative Mfume, I don't know. I said Brandon Scott would be in support of it. I mean, I haven't heard him speak about it, but I can't see this as something he wouldn't support because it's coming out of government forgiveness and it's something Joe Biden has the power to do with the sweep of a pen, y'all. 410-319-8888. Mario's on the phone from Columbia. Mario, how are you?
Not bad. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
I'm going to keep it rather short. I know that you had touched on the situation in Texas, which is a very unfortunate situation. But, you know, this is what you get under capitalism when you decide to, you know, deregulate energy sources, you know, to get the cheapest, the absolute cheapest you can get, which then compromises system reliability. And that's all I have to say about that, because they pushed for deregulation. And, you know, and people moving to Texas, you know, of course you want to live there for the lower cost of living, lower utility costs. But when you go cheap, you get cheap.
Yeah,
and this is what happened. That's all I want to say.
No, I definitely agree with you. Well, what we're seeing in Texas is just a result of what happened when you make those type of decisions. I don't like the fact that Texas politicians are saying, hey, let the people fend for themselves. I can't even imagine what it would be like to be in southern Texas all the way up to northern Ohio, frigid weather lingering, without electricity, without clean water, where in my house my water pipes break. I can't even imagine how angry I would be going from Texas outage to Texas outrage. It's really the carbon monoxide poisoning. They said is a disaster within a disaster. We're getting a ton of 911 calls about gas poisoning. You know why? Listen, before I go to Real Thomas, people were using their gas grills indoors and were running their cars inside closed garages. Now, I don't know a lot about cars. I do know that you're not supposed to run a car inside of a closed garage. I know that. That's how cold it is. People are now doing that, and at least 5 people have died of carbon monoxide poisoning in Texas. 410-319-8888. Real Thomas is on the phone. How are you, sir? Real Thomas, are you with us?
Hey, Dr. K, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Listen, to your last caller, he has no idea what the hell he's talking about. This is an act of God. Deregulation has nothing to do with this, with his power being out.
Mm-hmm.
This is an act of God. So, if I hear him correctly, because they deregulated stuff before then, it made God mad and had this big, you know, disaster to hit everybody. And we know that's not true, okay?
Now, may I, hold on now. I wonder, Real Thomas, don't hang up. I want to talk to you about this. But in terms of being an act of God, I thought the caller was talking about in terms of deregulation of the electric power grids, which is why people are now getting bills of $17,000 or so, because the price moved to like an Uber price, right, where it was just being driven up by supply and demand, and they couldn't pump more power into that because Texas has its own individualized power grids. They're not connected with anyone else. That's what I thought he meant in terms of deregulation, not necessarily the storm itself.
I thought he was talking about the storm.
Yeah, that definitely wasn't the result of politicians.
That's why this stuff has been happening because of deregulation. If that be the case, Dr. K, Hagerstown, Maryland, or Fletcher, Maryland, they have their own power supply. How come the lights are not out? How come the lights are not out over there?
I thought, and this is way into uncharted territory for me, but I thought when we're having an issue with power, I thought they're able to then tap into a bigger grid outside of Maryland and pump up the power. That's what I was always under the impression of, because they talked about whenever there was a concern that something's going to happen with the grid, they want to tap into the next power line, pump up the electric power like they do down south when there's a problem. I mean, I know there have been situations where my neighbors across the street, all of them will have their lights off. My lights are still on. We were told we were on a different grid. So I don't know why it plays out that way. I just know people are saying that Texas's system is very different, that they did not have anywhere to pull power from.
Well, I don't know much about Texas other than having to live there for 12 years, and the 12 years that I lived there, when these types of storms come up, I don't care where you pull from the power grid from, if the lights are going to go out. This is something that's beyond man's control. Okay. Like I said, if it wasn't above man's control, Hagerstown, Maryland, or Frederick, Maryland, whichever one of those areas that have their own power supply, how come they're not going out?
Okay. Again, as I said, I cannot answer that. But it'll be good to get an answer to it. Hopefully we will. Thank you so much. Let's see here.
One more quick thing, sir. You are right about Representative Kwayusi Mfume. He is on board with that. So he's one of the only ones that have came out and spoke out against what Brother Leo, in favor of what Brother Leo was talking about.
Okay. Okay, I appreciate that. So we can talk some more about this as we go forward. We have Ricky on the phone from Baltimore. Ricky, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Dr. K. Listen, I'm a little confused. I keep hearing it on television and everywhere about reparations, and it bothers me because my concept must be different. You see, I know that when you start giving away money in this country, diabolical things happen. And I'm thinking, how are we going to decide who gets this? I mean, you got people that passed for being ex-slaves all down for the last 200 years. Are we going to use DNA to find out what percentages? Or, I mean, I don't see it, unless it's like for college education, maybe we'll give you a couple. But if when I hear reparations, I think about money, and then I think, do you know how many black people they're going to be if they start giving away money? I mean, that's going to be scary. I mean, I know that sounds like, be careful what you ask for, because we just might get it. And maybe maybe I don't understand what reparations are, and I need someone to define reparations for me. Because I hear it on television and everywhere, and it scares me.
Okay, so hold on. Okay, let's break this down, because coming out of the end of American slavery, there was a promise made to help formerly enslaved people begin to build their net worth, to give them, because remember, they owned nothing. They were enslaved. So the promise was for 40 acres, a mule, and $50. That was what was committed to every enslaved man, woman, and child. It wasn't just, remember, you know, enslaved people were not allowed to get married, so it wasn't to the family. It was a way of trying to restore some balance after American slavery, which had gone from roughly 1619 or so up until 1865. When we as the Union, made all kind of concessions with the South, with the Confederates, with them coming back into the Union, one of the things taken off the table was the payment of reparations, particularly the part around land. Because white plantation owners did not want to give up land. So now there is a debt that has not been paid, which is why when you talk about how far behind we are in terms of the wage gap, in terms of health care, in terms of education, all of that comes out of the fact that slavery ended and people had nothing. They had no way to move. So they became sharecroppers, which means they were still working for their plantation owners and still working for nothing.
Okay.
Reparations is about restoring that debt, repaying that debt. When they did the math of what $50, 40 acres, and a mule would be today, it comes out to about $800,000. That's why they were saying the repayment of $800,000. Mm-hmm. In this country, it is not unheard of for America to pay reparations. We have paid reparations before. So that's why it shouldn't scare you. It's just a way of trying to restore something that was off. This is the reason why the debt is so high in the black community. We started so far back. We've been fighting for years to get to an equal playing field, and we have not gotten there.
I understand this, Dr. K, but the problem is going to come in when you implement. I'm saying you got to prove that you are a descendant of slaves. You can't just say, well, I'm second generation from Nigeria or Sierra Leone. Although you got to prove that you trace your, but you can use the census record to trace yourself back to a certain ancestry. But even at the end, you got to guess, is this 13-year-old on the 1880 census the same slave that was here that was 13? And that's it gets to be a legal barrier. And then all of the people that have passed, remember, like I say, we're all cousins in this country now because of the way the DNA is. You know, there's no black and white, really. That's just this thing that this political thing we have in our minds.
Right, but it is. I got to stop you there, Ricky. I appreciate you. So, folks, I think that before we chime out of here, maybe we should take the last couple of minutes and drill down deep into this because Ricky said some things when he used the word that it scares me. Look, since the second half of the last century, countries like Germany, like Austria, France, South Africa, and Canada have all amended past wrongs by paying reparations. It is not new. It's typically a form of reconciliation. The United States has supported reparations as a form of restorative justice. After World War II, It supported Jewish victims of the Holocaust in their demands for reparations from Germany and Austria. As recently as 2016, the United States Department of State helped Holocaust survivors access the payment owed to them by a French railways company that was an accomplice in deportations. So for some reason, slavery is just hard to wrap our heads around. I think it's because of how we see ourselves and how we see Black folks in this country. If you're not Black, it's how you see Black folks. And if you are Black, it's how we see ourselves. Look, this is about properly compensating the descendants of enslaved people. Reparations might be new to you. Reparations has been on the table since Michigan Representative John Conyers Jr. put it on the table in 1978. Back then, it was too progressive, even for progressive candidates. Today, even though the conversation remains, it's still hard for people to wrap their head around the fact that America owes Black people. It's just what it is. 70% of white Americans oppose it. Here's the deal. We worked in this country from 1619 to 1865. You did not pay us. Payment is now due. Run me my change. That's what we're talking about, folks. Don't be scared by reparations. Don't let it concern you. Let the government run us our money. And in fact, if you are that concerned, I'm talking to Faraji now, that maybe you don't want your money, send me Faraji's check. I'll take his check and my check. And trust me, there will be no guilt in the Whitehead household at all. Keep it here for For the Culture with Faraji comes on next. Have a safe weekend. I look forward to meeting you back here on Monday at 3 p.m. And let's have another conversation that matters. It was an honor and a privilege, folks.